often doing a session that has to do with speaking of a digital world and what I'm going to speak about, which is really some conversations around hermeneutics and the dialogical nature of thinking, and I'll get into what all that fancy language means without us actually knowing who we all are. Oops, sorry, I have to take it. So, we're going to pause on the introductions. We're not rushing anyone through them. It's really, I mean, we all came because we wanted to reconnect and celebrate these 30 years and know who we all are. And we're finally not at that place we were 10 years, at the 10-year celebration, where we, like, knew exactly who the 110 women in the RA were. Like, we are now 30 years out, I don't even know our number. Like, we've become a mass of humanity. And so, you know, your name, where you were ordained, how many years out you are, do you self-identify as being part of a particular generation of ordination, your space in the conversations with your female colleagues, and what you do with your rabbinate. Not just where you work, but what you do with your rabbinate. So let's imagine that those 10 minutes are actually going to be about what we take to get to know who's sitting around the table, but an understanding that, like, we need that because in order to actually study text from this lens, who one is, what position one brings to that text, and who one is in conversation with actually matters a lot, as opposed to it being this sort of disembodied, objective, anyone can see it this way approach to text. So there's a very intentional way in which how we engage with each other is part of how we engage with text as well. So I'm going to let you launch off if you're okay with that.
Sure. I'm Suzanne, and I was ordained from Ziegler 3 years ago. I'm currently in Ithaca. I'm director of education and youth programming and lots of fun stuff with kids and families. And I also write poetry and just a plug for
please
my,
plug.
my books just came out recently. I have some copies with me. So if anyone is interested, I'm happy to share and sell them.
That sounds beautiful.
There were a lot of questions.
There was a lot thrown out so that you can touch on the points that work for you. Yeah.
I'm Deborah Zucker, ordained from JTS in 2011, and since my ordination, I've been leading a synagogue in Peabody, Massachusetts. And I have something I just feel like raising up. I don't know if anyone's talked about it yet. Is the women rabbis listserv that we have, speaking of digital engagement. I was just telling some male colleagues yesterday who were complaining about Ravnet, how sort of completely opposite and so wonderful the women's listserv is, and how blessed we are to have that.
I'm Francine Green Ralston, and I was ordained in 98 from JTS, that's 17 years ago, and last summer I stepped down from 16 years of full-time pulpit work and moved my family to Montana, and I'm just on a self-managed sabbatical, consider myself a second generation. I think we were still first generation when we went out into the field, or I always thought that, but once I interviewed the first generation women, I realized second generation all around. So I'm out in Whitefish, half hour from Glacier Park. Our door is always open, kosher meal promised.
I'm Shelby Knotts. I was ordained here in 1988, so I'm first generation. And I just wanted to mention I was very interested in this topic because I'm my current position is director of congregational education. I realize I have the age span is my youngest students are 3, and my oldest student is 93. We started working with technology in the last few years, and we're doing, among other projects, we're doing something with a place called Jets Israel, Jerusalem, educational technology solutions, and we do distance learning with our seventh graders once a week. They do it from home, but it's real time, and we've seen some very, very interesting things happening in the online classroom, both the techniques you can use, but also in the dynamics among the children and with the teachers.
I'm Randy Mark. I was ordained in 1990 from RRC. Interesting when you talk about generational. I entered with the last class getting an external MA and was ordained with the first class getting an internal MA at RSC. I've been in New Jersey my entire career. I've been with my current congregation for 20 years. If we ever conclude our current negotiation, there'll be another 7 added on to that.
Very involved with Gerard Berman Day School for Solomon Check here.
It's a small synagogue, so I believe in community stuff. So I've been involved with the local JCC, the Gerard Berman Day School, the Federation.
My name is Rachel Safman. I graduated from St. Peter 2 years ago, so Suzanne and I spent considerable time in the same place at the same time. I am now in New London, Connecticut, as the rabbi of a large A-size congregation, and not only related to my position now, but related to kind of the path that took me into the rabbinate. I have a particular interest in the needs of congregations that are in a comparatively more peripheral location in the Jewish map, and in the ways in which different resources, including digital resources, can be used to give individuals in those communities, or individuals without Jewish communities, or without access to Jewish communities, a place in a larger Jewish world and access to churches.
I'm Paulette Kinsler. I was ordained here in 2001. I am the director of Jewish education at the 92nd Street Y, and much of my professional work there is on building relationships with those who choose to come in the doors of the 92nd Street Y rather than the synagogue, either for Jewish or for after school for children and for introduction to Judaism for adults. So I'm blessed to do a lot of life cycle events, both bar mitzvah and weddings. But in our after school program, I'd like to be able to bring in more technology. A lot of my faculty has been asking for that.
I'm Susan Gulak. I was ordained in 1986 from the Academy for Jewish Religion. So I guess I'm first generation. I did 15 years of pulpit work in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, Henrietta, New York, just outside of Rochester, and Willimantic, Connecticut. And then when I became a single parent, and I have special needs kids, I moved into chaplaincy. I am a prison chaplain with the New York State Department of Corrections and a psychiatric hospital chaplain with the Capital District Psych Prison. And I also teach a craft appeal group at the Psych Center.
Some reasons.
I'm Dahlia Kronisch. I'm ordained 10 years next week from this fine institution. And I work in education. I've been working at the Heschel High School here in Manhattan. My students think they're prisoners.
You were bringing them on the tour of the match and set it up.
But most of us think they're prisoners. They are far from prisoners. I don't think they're honestly. They're all led.
Actually, I taught middle school at the day school for 1 year before I went to the Psych Center. No, the Psych Center.
Yes, but nobody teaches middle school.
Yes, I don't work at middle school.
We're all smart enough to know that.
Hi, I'm one of three Ziegler grads named Rachel around this table. My name is Rachel Bovitz, and I was ordained from Ziegler in 2001. pioneer there, because we're definitely part of the first group to go all the way through. In those days, it was 4 years year-round. I'm new here in New York. I've always been in Los Angeles, a whole bit in a lot of adult education, and now, very funny, I'm working here at JTS, which is really kind of fun, and I'm working on a new initiative called Initiative Talk on millennial engagement. I've just started. Oh, and my other interest, my non-working rabbinate stuff is non-professional these days, is I'm a student and a madrika of Ira Stone and New Star Leadership.
I'm Rachel Brown. I'm also a Ziegler graduate in 2005. I was just told that I'm a fourth generation. I just learned this at breakfast. For the last 10 years, I've been the rabbi of a small congregation in a town called Phoenixville, which is west of Valley Forge. But I'm actually leaving after almost a whole school year of a very nasty negotiation process. I'm leaving, and I find myself in placement very late in the placement season. So as I consider what I want to do next, I have a wild fantasy about going into business for myself, making a lot of money, and putting that money into saving victims of human sex trafficking and children of very poor, depressed neighborhoods who don't get the kind of education and adult attention that children... I mean, it's a wild fantasy. But, you know, a famous guy said, if you will it, it is no dream. I don't know what I'm going to do next. I love public work, but this was a very, very painful relationship.
You should talk to Heather Altman, who has been around the conference, because she has done some significant work around advocacy for victims of
Heather
sex trafficking.
Yes.
And Deborah
Ornstein. Deborah Ornstein.
What?
Debbie Ornstein.
Oh, really? Okay. Thank you. I hope it's okay to say this with the two men in the room. If rabbinical school had looked like this, it would have been such a different experience, I think. What?
True that. I was in the first class at JTS that was, my class was more than 50%
women. Wow.
Wow.
It's the first class that we were like 65% women. I mean, we were a small class, but more was women.
I think the first class was 50% just because...
Everyone had been waiting.
Yeah, but it wasn't the school. The rest of the school wasn't. It was
our class was more than 50%.
Yeah.
Well, when we moved into your class, we became more than 50%.
I was the only student.
At the whole academy.
Eddie's going to be like, come on, let's get back to us.
Great meeting, everyone. I'm Eddie Grunstein. I was ordained here at JTS in the last century.
I'm on a horse.
1999. And I serve a congregation in Boynton Beach, Florida, where everyone's Bubba's and Zadie's live.
Congregates that winter there.
Yeah. I love,
he knows them all.
I love sharing congregants with people and sharing regards and all that. And yet, even in a very senior environment, I'm interested in advancing the congregation to the digital age, which I've tried to do, making YouTube music videos, and I blog. And one thing I did interesting, which is more of an extracurricular activity, is... you might be familiar with a book edited by Chaim Herring recently called Keeping Faith in Rabbis, and I contributed an essay called The Roar of the Cat Rabbi, The Vital Role of Introverts in the Congregational Rabbinate. And part of my research, in my research I found that the internet is actually a useful and important outlet for people of all personality types, but especially people who might be introverted, to reach out and have a global audience. And the essay is self-describing in many ways, but I think it's a useful tool that can expand our relevance.
I'm Rona Shapiro. I was ordained in 1990. The RA and its inimical way manages to insult, and you know, we're only honoring people who entered in 1984, so by the time I entered 1985, everything was I am.
We honor you.
We're very proud of
the first generation.
I am part of the first generation, right? In Woodbridge, Connecticut, which is basically New Haven, and have been Hill director in Berkeley for 10 years. I worked with my aunt here in New York for 7 years. I was a pulpit rabbi in Cleveland for 6 years, and I've been 2 years in Connecticut. And I came not because of any interest in things digital, which I profess a fair amount of ignorance with. But just, I was very interested in the thread of the Talmud and
Sigil. Hi, I'm Diane Coloresis, and I'm thrilled to be the Talmud of my class. And we graduated together in 1995. So, is the question, sorry, I came late, is the question like,
just
talk about your whole career and then your personal life?
yourself identify as a generation, your rabbi.
Just so we know the time. Grew up in a world of Syrian Jews in Brooklyn where I could not even imagine that the world could be that way, or really even in the work world. I've been all over the Jewish map professionally, in education, Kral, Bronfman Youth Fellowship, PGA Federation, Schechter High School, and now at Roman Roof for the last almost 3 years. And the light has been there, it's been very wonderful, and a departure from other models. So I run a Hebrew school and adult education, and my Hebrew school students are no Jews. They don't think they're prisoners. And I'm also married, mother of 3 kids, who have special needs, so that's also been a consuming surprise.
One day I'm going to find a doctoral student who is interested in doing a study of the unique nature of children with special needs who are children of clergy, because I suspect that there is an interpersonal spiritual side to parenting in that relationship that we have to uncover and then share out.
Yeah, I've actually taught classes for parents of children with special needs, taught Judaism as a spiritual resource for them.
So peace then has to be on our radar.
And I think we read perspective disorder.
I think we breed for spectrum disorder in the Jewish community.
Yeah. We breed spectrum disorder.
Absolutely.
Yeah. My dad said there's a genetic pool if you're Eastern European. For all kinds of mood disorders.
Yeah.
Mood disorders.
There's all sorts. I'm Karen Rees-Medved, although as I've noticed in the last 24 hours in this space, I'm sort of Karen Gluckstern Rees-Medved, and sort of multiplicity of identities that I bring in. I was ordained in 95 here. I'm also a graduate of joint program here, so I entered these gates exactly 28 years ago.
And when there were gates.
There were actual gates at the time. Matilda Schechter was my home. Goldsmith was my home. I started working on a doctorate here in Talmud. I'm part of the community of women who consider ourselves proud dropouts from the Talmud program here. I think all of us but Leah Wheeler are also rabbis. But I did go over to NYU and decided that it was not the right space for me to work with dead esoteric white men, but that I'd really be interested in working with living human beings, and so I became an educational researcher in the Jewish Education Program at NYU. And for a while, was really working professionally as a professor of Jewish education, and had the opportunity
opportunity a few years ago to migrate a piece of that identity into faith-based education at Northeastern University. And so now I find myself as a full-time faculty member at Northeastern University's Graduate School of Education, which is a fully virtual school of education. And I'm part of the doctoral education faculty there. And so I work at the doctoral level. I do most of my research around instructional design and digital education for educational leaders. A lot of work on guiding theses in that realm. And then I continue and am now launching for them a minor in faith-based educational leadership, in which we're going to be exploring the meaning of faith-based education in America in particular, legal implications for leadership and so forth and so on. Our primary audience is actually the Catholic colleges around the country. But I have a number of students who work in Muslim schools who come to seek me out because my knowledge of Jewish identity plays out really well for where the Muslim world is right now in the States in figuring out how to do this education. So those are the pieces that I bring. I do qualitative research, which really matters right now for what we're about to do because it is about people, stories, and conversations. And I work in a very postmodern world, which means I'm going to throw jargon out this morning and you're going to stop me because I work advising 30 doctoral students, and I read jargon all day, and I regurgitate jargon all day to the point that I don't notice, because when you're a faculty of 30 people who all sit around talking about positionality and hermeneutics, and that's your common language, you forget that sometimes you need to decode yourself. Now, while I was at JTS way back in the day, women and gender really was our heated space for that conversation. And Francine and I were part of a really wonderful small group who had started at the time the Isha El Achota Women's Center that needed to navigate the shared spaces with dedicated spaces for us to be able to continue to grow ourselves. And primarily growing ourselves with leadership skills, with voice, with capacity to really open ourselves up. What I have been finding really interestingly is that that thing carries over now as we see modern leadership models transforming and as we see digital models of leadership transforming, so that what at the time in the 90s at JTS seemed like a very unique problem of religious identity actually gets blown up into this being a prominent discourse of a field with some interesting actual interventions around exactly what Eddie was sort of foreshadowing us, I swear I didn't plant it, around the notion that in a digital space you can conceal embodiment and conceal identity and therefore have voice and therefore assume leadership.
Just say that. Now, let's say that again.
Yes, yes, although I think it's...
In a digital space,
she wrote me beautifully.
You can conceal and
identity and conceal embodiment.
So that you can have voice.
Identity.
So that you can really have voice.
Have voice.
Can you pass out the handout so we can write it on the internet?
Yes. Okay, I can. I'm going to give you two more sentences and then pass it out because you're going to see this dump and you're going to freak out me. And you're all going to say, I can't read. We're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about that. That's it. That's what we're doing here. So, right. So, there's three areas of research that I'm going to be babbling about when I get into Babble Professor education mode, that when I'm not doing my Jewish stuff for the next hour, and that's going to be the education in the digital world. It's going to be the networking in the digital world. And that's both social and knowledge networking. And it's going to be relationships.
What's knowledge networking?
Oh, it's going to be, you're going to love it. You're going to love it. It's Facebook around stuff that matters.
What was the third? I'm sorry.
Relationships, networking, and education.
Relationships.
I love that I'm taking notes and Karen's teaching.
So the other slice of this, and this is why it spirals, because it's like, oh my God, one head that has to contain all these. There's one other slice, which is religion. Right? In order for this to be all encompassing, is there a unique nature of religion, religious text, religious community that has traits that can be understood in a digital space as similar, different, supported, not at all talking about the fancy, flashy tools. Because the tools will do whatever we want it to do, but the nature of, again, that relationship, that education, the availability, what is going on for religion in that space? So you've got leadership, you've got gender, you've got religion, and how does that all spiral around? And in particular with this little focus, because we have to break something down and say, okay, we're only going to look at this focus of voice as it relates to leadership role. Now, here's my thesis, and with that, I'll start passing this on. My thesis is that we actually have incredible access to doing this well because we come from this rabbinic tradition. And that unlike other religious traditions who walked away from the Greek Plato model of logic, the Talmud and the way we study Talmud, because we know those two are totally different things, the Talmud and the way we study and the way that we have been taught to believe that that is authentic voice in Judaism actually lends itself to us breaking open some barriers and doing this in a really well manner that can grow us up. So now why the small teensy-weensy print? Because I was a Hebrew college professor there for 3 years, and it is amazing how at Hebrew college, after 6 months, you can never print anything on a piece of paper anymore without feeling your heart wrenched out of you because you are hurting the trees. So I could not possibly send a packet that was more than 4 or 5 pages to be photocopied because that's just become so deeply ingrained in me as just a practice you do not do. And as a virtual professor, I actually never send packets. I just send QR codes. Well, but we're not quite
we
there
don't know
here.
What that is,
I know.
I haven't learned how to scan those yet.
A QR code. It's just a little code, like a barcode, and then it would just pop up on your iPad sitting in front of me, which of course most of us don't have because we're studying text. So we're looking at a piece of paper. So my compromise was really, really small text. I'm sorry, it sounds pathetic when I explain it, but it really made sense inside of my head when I was preparing. Well, so I actually, right, so you get a little bit of the Rashi and bigger, bolder text on like one of the following pages because I knew that you would eat me alive with the Rashi. And then the last page, which I know is the page you really wanted, and I know you're going to read it in advance, but we will come back to that back page at the end, even if we've only gotten through a small piece of text, because that's where we'll play with how all of these elements of research and text fit together. So, now we're back to our text. I gave you 2 samples of text. The piece from Sanhedrin, and I tried, honestly, to go with the more familiar, because the point is not actually to encounter brand new text for us. The point is for us to encounter a way that we think in a meta fashion. I think back there. A way that we approach in a meta-fashion text study that isn't decoding. And when I say decoding, I'm thinking read, translate, look up in Jastrow, vocalize. But that meta-reading, the hermeneutic reading, and how that contributes, if we get into that practice again and go back to that way of reading Talmud, how that contributes actually to us making the digital world feel that much more familiar. And one of the best pieces that we know in education is anytime anything feels familiar, it goes from being new to being a habit. And Harvard research has shown us that all things that are habits of mind can become habits of heart.
That's meta reading.
Meta. Big. Hermeneutics.
No, what I mean by that, yeah.
Here we go. Here we go. Never know how far back I have to go. All right, so let's do a quick reminder of ourselves. Now, I apologize to Ziegler. I could probably... probably do this with the Ziegler faculty quickly if I think about it, but the examples that come to mind are all JTS professors. So JTS, you've got the Richard Kellman and the Judy Helpmans, right? You're reading words, you're counting the number of rabbis, you're doing decoding. David Kramer, his work on food. Jacob Neusner, his work on the sociological stuff, emergence of the temple. Daniel Boyarin, Levinas. That's all postmodern hermeneutics. That's the metas. That's, and Boyarin is the
reading
one,
for theme.
Reading for theme, although Boyarin reads for meta. Right? Boyarin will say, you can't read a sugya and take it off the dock and say, this is what the Talmud says. He says that so vehemently that it, sometimes you're not sure where he's drawing the line, because he's really looking at it as the crafted, uniform items. He looks at dialogical, the conversational pieces, right? The they bring in a Tana, they bring in a Mishnah, Rabbi this is conversing with Rabbi that, and Boyarin will say to us, but that's not dialogical, that's constructed. So while Shama Friedman is making, and you know, those, that class of Talmud scholars is having us chart our sugyas. Everybody, I don't care where you went to school, you've all done that, right? You've all charted your sugya.
More than we might have.
Boyarin is going in the opposite. He's saying, yeah, it's interesting to see it, but not because you actually believe anybody said that, but because you're really curious, and this is a little Richard Kellman, about how that stam has created a story by pretending there's a dialogue. And what's the political undercurrents of interpretation that happen when that's your gist of the story? So that's the meta. So hermeneutics comes from Gadamer, rejection and reaffirmation. We've all done this on women. What's the status of women in the Talmud? I either reject the way women are treated or I reaffirm. Look, there's Bruria. That's wonderful. I'm going to affirm her. Look, there's Bruria. She committed suicide. I'm going to reject that. We're going to look at that in 3 minutes.
Right? Do
that same thing. Right. Right. And Gadamer is all the rejection. And then there's Heidegger, who's the transformation. That's what we do, actually. We do the Heidegger hermeneutics. We do the, oh, look, there's Bruria. That's wonderful. I'm going to reject the bad stuff, affirm the good stuff, and reinterpret it so that I now can say, I'm like Bruria. Now I have a model for women leadership who's scholars. That's hermeneutics, like a regel achat as a game. It's the impulse to encounter meaning, to assume that all meaning needs to be understood from your position and from the position of the people who you're sitting with, so that this same conversation that I could have if I'm teaching it to a room full of educational leaders who have never seen a page of Talmud could never be the same talk, even though my academic training is that you write one talk and you present it at 6 conferences, right? So the postmodern academic training is you can never present a paper at 6 conferences without changing it. We do this hermeneutics all the time. Like, this is our way of talking. This isn't unfamiliar. What's unfamiliar is giving it the label and thinking of it as actually a process. Now, the process is the piece that's familiar. So that process, encountering the text, determining that either a meaning of something is obscure or uncomfortable, needing to determine what you do with that. You have an option to ignore. You have an option to reject. You have an option to affirm it in a new way that shifts it, and you have an option to completely reinterpret. You don't really get away from one of those options no matter what you do, except for one, which is to walk away from the entire endeavor. And that's going to work for you whether it's alien or familiar material, which is why we're doing familiar, because And alien and familiar, not just I've seen it before, but it's alien to my life experience. So when you're talking about a community and a religious text that's alien to their life experience, how does this begin to support conversations that can create access ramps? And notice it's a plural. It's not there's one way into the text, but that there's always multiplicities of access ramps to get to it.
So when you're saying you have options to ABC, you're talking to the you who's an educator or the you who's a consumer of these texts?
You, the reader. This is all very the personal. Your ego has these choices. Should we play with this?
Yes.
Nat, I think that's enough framing. If I keep talking, you're going to like roll your eyes at me. Yeah. So let's do... It's already 20 of 12, so can I just quickly let you all know that... 20 of 10, sorry. I'm just...
What's after this?
Another Limut session. I'm going to just tell you quickly. All right, Sanhedrin, this is that Elohim Shetovea et Adam, the notion that God who stamps coins and the faces of humanity, the many faces of humanity, the text, that's that second page, just so you know why it's there, the text quoted are Bereshit and Mishle. I mean, we're all Jewish geeks here, so we all do this, right? You all have your favorite flavor of the month text. So Mishle is my favorite flavor of the month Tanakh text. I have been studying and teaching Mishle for the last 3 years with this joyful abandonment. I've never in my previous life as a literate Jew ever had read Mishle in any kind of serious way. And I am fascinated by it as a wisdom literature, as this literature on women. And anyone who needs to walk out and break, you can walk out. Yes. So that's why that text is here, because the way that Mishle portrays women versus the way humanity is portrayed in this first piece of Sanhedrin is that fascinating alien familiar play. Huh. Because you read that and you're drawn in, like, that's that general assumption, but this Matzveot Mishnah, it's like everyone's taught this by time. Like, kids know this, they encounter it. Oh, God makes us all special, a human image. But then when you start to dig deep and look at the way in which the essentialization of gender is captured in that particular text, it's really quite astonishing. And the way a woman can, on the one hand, be God's partner of chokhmah and wisdom, and then all of a sudden become this evil persona who, by using all of her sexual prowess, can take you off to the wrong track, is really quite powerfully remarkable. With a little bit of a suggestion of there being a gender continuum in the Bereshit story, and that humanity was actually not created as binary, potentially, if you play with some exegetics there. So now I've teased you with all that because we're going to spend more time on Bruria. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So Bruria, squint your eyes really, really well. Teensy little text, I know, because it's too dumb. What I should have done is actually run to the baby drash and just grab a few volumes for everyone so we could sit around with it. So on Nun Gimel Amud Bet, which is on that first page of Bruria, the Bruria story... The second, sorry. That's it. So if you go all the way down to the bottom, oh my gosh, do you all remember when Torah was able to like look at a dove and just tell you how many lines up?
Yeah.
And like her eye just always knew it without having to sit and count. Yes. So we're like Deborah. Of course Deborah Steinmetz, right? Sorry. Four lines up from the bottom in the middle. Rabbi Yossi Haglili. We are squinting our way together for a little bit. Yeah. Okay, so here, here's what I want to suggest.
Not Shaka.
How bad is the text for everyone?
We have bigger.
It looks real.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So are there enough people where you feel like I could actually pause this for 3 minutes and just let you do a quick read through and small little chavrutas around the table? And if anyone needs, we can shift chairs a little just to look. And then come back together. Yeah, so that's a good chance to introduce yourselves. Eddie, do you know Rachel? You want to?
Is that a link?
Okay, now pretend for a minute that you are not prepping this for translation. Without any prep, without any tools, without anything. What's the gist of the story?
She's making fun of this idea that you should be stuck here.
Wait, right. She being...
Oh,
so we have a name.
Oh, she's making fun of it. First she's correcting him, but then...
She's fixing him.
Well, like, don't talk about it because they're such fools. And then she's citing all these rabbinic texts to say, and it's not here, and you should know this. And
so, I mean, so
forth. So we were such fools.
How much of this did you know because you know how to read Rashi?
We hadn't even gotten to the Rashi.
You haven't gotten to the because you've read it before. So how much of the story do you remember as you start looking at the text? You're like, oh, this must be when.
Right.
Right. That Rashi seems to make sense to me, given the words of the Gemara. Imagining a meta that's not there, you're saying?
No, opposite. I think we can imagine a meta without knowing what's there.
We imagine a meta because of our time, because of our moment in time.
Right, and because we bring our personal knowledge. Nobody needed to know. I kept humming and hawing because I wasn't going to say I'm not telling you, but no one needed to know what the word Greece meant.
You were purposely.
We could have played Shama Friedman, right? We could have really spent the next hour investigating that word. And I'm not putting down, I mean, I'll be the first to send my students to a Jastrow to look something up and to learn the tools and techniques, because to be able to get bodies of literature, part of what we need to do is decode and figure it out.
That's another way of saying, part of what we need to do is pay attention to the language.
Right. But part of what we do is actually we don't listen to every word, right? That's why texting is such a great thing, because you can text paragraphs without vowels, like you can read Gemara without vocalization. You fill in the blanks because cognitively that's what your brain is trained to do. So you can read the story of Bruria and you know, here she is. She has presented herself as chastising a man walking down the street who's speaking to her, because we know halakha is you don't do that behavior. And why don't you do that behavior? Oh, look at this great dialogical piece. Look at all these textual evidences of how you are not allowed to, because women are, in fact, they're just secondary class citizens who are kalot rosh, like they're not smart. And in the process of doing so, she overturns her own logic. And without any decoding, we sort of have access to this story she's telling because we can stand in it. There's access ramps in which we can place ourselves. We have background and narrative, so we bring our life experience into it. That's our positionality piece. But the suggestion of hermeneutics is actually also that... sometimes it's okay to skip the details because it's the big picture. It's what is the thrush of it. Only because many different coverages around the table asked the question. And so that was a nice moment to be able to pause and say, okay, well let's look at what happens when you don't answer that question.
But I mean, to take it back to the discussion of where this is or isn't parallel, is, does or doesn't prepare us to participate in this virtual dialogue. It's exactly that piece that's either missing or potentially misrepresented when you're having dialogues with individuals through increasingly virtual means of communication.
That
you become focused just on the content, because in a sense, and this is something I went through when I was teaching university students, that Joe's pretty good web page on whatever Roman history looks just as authoritative, especially if he does a nice job, or she going at Joe does just as good a job formatting the page or something, as something that's from Encyclopedia Britannica, which has no longer exists. But they look equally authoritative. You have notion that maybe Joe's got an agenda.
Yes, and that's, I'm looking at you, Dahlia, but because there's a really good reason with, so when I look at Dahlia, I'm like, oh, and I know Dahlia because I've had the chance to watch her teach. She, in her head, can fill in the blanks of all of these textual references. That changes the entire story. Because if you're reading this and you can't silence those textual references, that's a whole nother layer of dialogical textual reading going on simultaneous to reading this text that's helping you fill in the blank. So the notion of filling in meaning is still some kind of seemingly hierarchical space, which is ironic and is exactly what you're talking to, Rachel, because we keep thinking of digital as flat. We keep thinking of postmodern as everyone has same equal access. And yet, I know only because I'm presuming to know, but I sort of do feel like I know that Dahlia's richness of drill down depth and capacity in this, because of her positionality as an instructor of Talmud with great skills, means she's bringing layers of meaning I might not be knowing. The question is it necessary, to whom and why? Or whether for each person at their slice of moment in time, that access ramp serves to be enough. Go ahead, and then we'll look at that.
I think
later.
I'm having a hard time with this because I'm thinking about how I hear people sort of accessing because they feel they can and lambasting the Quran. That's what I'm thinking of, is the way that people bring a text that they actually don't have any background in and have no knowledge of, you know.
Yeah.
We have the same awful kinds of things, but we know how to and how they have been reused, reinterpreted, repurposed. And so it makes me feel like, how can that be a legitimate way of accessing text without, you know, a teacher or you know, or someone who has the background, because you see it done so terribly with other texts.
Yes. So let's parking lot for 5 minutes, okay, if we can. This notion, if I can reframe it, and you'll tell me if this is what you're asking. If the notion of facilitating knowledge means losing the notion of authority of knowledge or expertise of knowledge.
Or is there a limit to the legitimacy of this methodology?
Right. And the legitimacy is really around that notion of what is flat then, and where does flat take us? When I'm saying flat and shorthand, is that resonating for everybody, by the way?
Equal access, right?
So there's a book, The Flat World, that speaks of the digital world as being, as creating this next generation in which knowledge is flat. The massive open online courses, the MOOCs, that were big last year and now are sort of not so big because, in fact, they don't have any financial capacity, and that's what made them interesting, but because nobody could actually figure out how to make you pay for them, people lost interest in them. That's the notion of flat, that everybody can have equal access to knowledge and teach each other from their space of authority, and that's based on this notion that the digital massive world flattens.
So there isn't a value judgment there, waiting for
other
people to
know
flat.
Right.
As a matter of fact, we think it's a value that things should be accessible.
And I think that's the open question still, actually. I think this notion of flat A is an open question of, in a religion that has hierarchy, can you even talk of flat? And then
it's a little bit of knowledge danger.
And then the second question that Deborah's asking of, when it becomes flat, what's the self-awareness? And in religion, I think it pushes our buttons differently, because when it's flat around a knowledge network, I'm like jumping five steps ahead to move back to text, but in a knowledge network, which is a Facebook around solve a problem, so it's not a space where you get onto a big network to say, here's pretty pictures of my cat, but it's a knowledge where it's a network like a Facebook, but where you get on and you specifically say, I need to fire somebody tomorrow. They are over the age of 65. I have the following documentation. Can you all help me figure out how to process this so that we don't have a legal suit against us? The person understands some of what's been going on, and the team doesn't feel like the rest of them are in a vulnerable space. And then in the matter of hours, people in your little network worked with you as a reader response, peer review kind of team to help you work through the process. That's kind of like Women Rap.
Yes.
Women Rap doesn't really...
Is that what you're calling flat, though?
No, that's not flat. That's what I'm calling a knowledge network. Right. Flat is companies like Coke We'll use that knowledge network method, and we'll have the janitor and the CEO on a team together problem solving something where no one gets a veto over the other.
Yes.
Everyone has an equal voice in that problem solving moment.
Alcoa started.
Regardless of their position in the company. That's pretty flat. Companies that say they're flat and don't are the companies where that team doesn't include the janitor or the administrative assistant or the person who answers the phones, but only includes middle and upper management, and there it's really just about reinforcing the upper management.
If anybody who works in a school knows, it's the janitor and the school secretary.
Who know everything.
Yes.
It's more than information, right?
They control
how people operate, what mess they do for
others. Right.
And they know which children are in need and who needs food.
Yes.
And who needs clothing, and whose parents are crazy and the kids need to be protected, and when children's services need to be called.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people who know that. And they're not, by the way, protected by confidentiality in our educational laws in this country right now.
Confidentiality.
Yeah. All right, can we just look at this Mishnah and this Avodah Zarah again, not because we're going to understand the text deeply, but because we're going to understand the interrelationship. I know. I'm sorry, I made you turn the page, but just to go back to that full page, why am I not cutting the snippets? Because if we were continuing for another hour and a half, one of the things we would actually do is not just look at Beruya's story, but what's her story in the context of the page about all these other women, all these other scenarios. Why is this coming out? What voice is counteracting which other voice? These two pieces are, what's the hermeneutics of what's being held in the back of some author's head when they're codifying this text, and presumptions of knowledge. And then the second one, the Rashi, is just a good reminder for ourselves of, oh, that's the story I was thinking about as I was reading this other story, because today I have both of them in my head, and the challenge for those of us who know too much text to step away from the text,
mm-hmm.
put our hands down and say, oh, I can't actually read it clean. So the Rashi text, let's start just because that is that fun exercise. It's nice, big, and fat, and I've been talking a lot. Who wants to read? Just the Rashi Avodah Zarah. I even didn't type it in Rashi font so that.
Okay.
Zai is like, after that previous page, Rashi font was not the issue. Go!
Vegan to Amri, Mishu Ma'asa to Buya. Shapama Fats, Liglaga, Ash Amru Chokamim, Nashim Datan Kalot, Hen Elayu. Marla, Chayech, Sofech, Leodot, Ledibrehem, Ziba, Lechad, Vitamidav, Lenasota, Ledavar Avera, Vehafsirba, Yamin Rabin, Ashenit Ratsurin,
Nitratset.
Buchasha Noda,
type of laugh.
Thank you, Rashi.
Yeah. I really could do this after taught his daughters, you know?
So first of all, liglaga, one of those awesome words like bakuk, 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 bakuk.
To turn her around? Roll her over.
Tease, make fun of. Stick your tongue. Go. Yes. But it sounds like the action. Those are my favorite words.
Onomatopoeia.
So, what is Rashi reminding us that the Beruya Ma'aseh was? That she was retaining her bragging rights. Because she really was brilliant and according to Rashi's interpretation of these stories, was not modest about it. God forbid you put yourself forward, right? That's not the meta, though. And so Rabbi Meir sets her up.
And she falls.
And he gets one of his students to go after her sexually.
To seduce her.
To seduce her. To trap her. We've seen this play out in Washington, D.C. a few times. We see it play out in Rashi, too. There's no creativity, by the way, in any of this.
There's
no creativity here at all. Like, really, this was the best you could do, Rabbi Meir? Really?
And why did you do that to your own wife?
And
you can't
hold out.
You can't hold your own intellectually. You can always just...
Right. Right. So after many, many days, like, she held out, and... You know, when you sit and go and look at all the text on the text, it's all about the halacha. She knew it was halachically wrong. She knew it was halacha. It could just equally as well have been about the human nature of relationships.
Is Rashi the first occurrence of this story? Like, what's the precedent? Is there a precedent for this?
A Rashi story? I have never seen a Braita that has this story. I've only seen Rashi be the one who's quoted as being the one to tell
this
story.
I'm just so curious
when
we get this.
So Rashi, the medieval commentator.
Right.
Right.
It seems like a lot to me.
It seems like a lot for him to say this.
Without it being
an inherited
story, yeah.
Well,
but
as far as I know, I've never seen a textual reference.
What did you say?
I've heard negative things made up about women in authority to cut them down.
Totally.
All the time.
Totally.
Things that are so to be heard, right?
Yeah, the stories that come
right.
back to you.
Right.
Oh, there are no resemblance to that.
Can I just ask a question? Are you making, because of the mention of Rabbi Meir at the end of the decision, that he was the one who set her up?
Yes.
He hung himself, and then he left town. We also have elsewhere
the Rabbi Meir is her spouse.
Right.
So Rashi is almost obliquely referencing that without actually coming out.
Wait, we have elsewhere the
Rabbi Meir is her spouse.
There's also
her mayor's her husband.
Oh yeah, yeah.
There's also the whole story of her sister.
Yes, there's endless literature on Luria, and all of them are this theme.
I'm thinking again about the meta. Like if we saw a Rashi about a man who was bragging and like got. Mm-hmm. What was coming to him, mm-hmm. I could see being really happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
But we see a woman who's
being put down,
and we hate it because we all know that that could happen to us. But it's interesting, like, when do we value the sniut?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's a little heretical. Are we even willing to value sniut even though we have so far to go in terms of putting our power in the world?
Mm-hmm. What I would push at a meta level would be to say that can you read Ruria's story elsewhere in the Gemara without hearing Rashi's ending? Rashi is the only reference we have as to what happens to Ruria. We don't know whether she lives, dies, thrives, doesn't. We have a Rashi centuries later, and when we teach the Ruria story, we teach it seamlessly as one canon of literature.
No, I don't.
Right? Well, right. We being a Jewish world in which stories are shared,
it's a Jewish world,
right? yeah. But if you ask your average Jew on the street, knows Buria.
A Jew on the street, they've never heard of Buria.
Walk into a high school and ask them about Buria. You know, how does she die? And they'll tell you she hanged herself. The comparison is asking any Hebrew school kid in first grade about Abraham, and they will tell you about the idols, right? And then you ask them to go open a Tanakh when they're in fifth grade, and you have
right.
the beginning
so what's the
of
point
your
that the meta becomes part of the primary text?
The dialogical grows, that each piece of the story keeps growing. That if, right, we used to think of the Talmud and the margins as being the outside inside of the text, but in fact,
it becomes the inside.
It's actually a merged text. It is the inside. The margins don't stay on any margin. They are not, we don't treat Rashi as anything less sacred than the Gemara.
But actually,
in the Gemara,
in this
while
room, that the real inside text is our feminist
reading
of it.
Reading
even
absolutely.
Before Rashi,
absolutely.
I think that was the primary in this room.
Yes,
the Rashi might be primary in other
yes.
contexts.
And that's the hermeneutic. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That the position of your voice is exactly the primary. And so, let's go back to that ending, right? Because that's exactly that question of flat and authority and hermeneutics and dialogical. If the dialogue's not really a dialogue, because it's constructed, and if the interpretation is open, I mean, Diane, what you really just played with was rejection. We reject Rashi, or we reject Rashi's reading because we don't like the way we're speculating about how to treat Berea. We affirm because we think Rashi is so brilliant. There's so much detail to this. He must know a tradition. We need to integrate this and make this a piece of our understanding that even a Breweria can have a complex identity. And we affirm, actually, that we advance women because we don't treat them all as saints, that they are as complex as anyone else because they're human. Or we reinterpret and we begin to tease apart and say, well, this is Rashi, who's medieval, and he's a commentator, and it's his one voice on a text that is multiple layers of voice, and we actually keep pulling apart the strands because we can live with actually being comfortable, being all spread out, and then need to figure out how we integrate back for people who need something that's more whole,
or that is how the male reader in those times mm-hmm. through to the present in many
yeah.
communities,
yeah.
Read that text. So we're learning about how the male reader has experienced Berea's
right.
brilliance.
Yes. Yeah. And so there's that first
make
spiral.
A connection with that. Oh,
right.
That's
so there's
spiral.
Your first spiral. Your first spiral is decoding that dialogical sodia. Decoding, and the dialogical sodia is that page, is multiple pages, is that body of knowledge, however the layers, which might lead you to deconstruct, reconstruct, or just construct understandings. God, I'm sickeningly postmodern there. that becomes your own hermeneutic. So your own personal quest for meaning happens there. Second spiral is when you become more self-aware of that piece, it becomes a tool. It doesn't become just your own way of making sense of religion, but a tool for thinking of how this could make sense for others. How do we stop just telling them a story or giving them a the Talmud says about and give them more opportunities to actually enter into the dialogue, enter into the dynamics without being afraid that they're going to get lost and without being worried that they're going to lose the sense of an authority in that messiness. That's the flat. And then there's a cognitive piece. If we feel we can gain voice in these digital spaces, and by digital spaces I'm not talking just social media, I'm really talking digital as an approach to a world that is global, in which any single voice on it can be equal to any other voice because there's a recognition that each of us in human nature brings something to the table, and even in an opposition, I gain knowledge and understanding of myself so that the space isn't a, oh, that's a flat reading because I'm seeing it, but that I actually have so much more work and responsibility because I have to every single time respond to it. That's the downside of it, actually, is what we've been doing is we're still working in the space of receiving material and transmitting material as opposed to working material. So it's very easy to receive, and it's very easy to teach as transmission. And that's the spaces you're talking to are places where that kind of work happens. Whereas like on Women Rav, where it's a knowledge network where people all have to be at the table to engage with one another to create and produce. And that's the activity that I would say is a space for racial visibility and for allowing voices that have been silenced, not silenced, but just silent by nature of the dynamics, to be able to affirm themselves, because you can really then have access at a table. People who are introverts and don't speak in a room, there's enough time and space and lags for everyone to have the opportunity to have that valued. And I actually think that's what the text does. Because the text travels across time, and once you get to the flat page, every voice on it is equally valued. We have absolutely no idea, except in the ways we reconstruct it. Minority and majority opinions about these voices, except that they all got onto the canonized page at some point. So I think it's a good framing for that digital space. As we begin to reconceive it for religious purposes, we just are still in the endeavor of figuring out how we grow those relationships together.